democracy is promoted and protected against disinformation and against subversion campaigns.
An enduring global security alliance. It's Tuesday, April 13th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online. You can find us at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, John Bolton tells VOA about North Korea. Pros and cons for vaccine passports. Virus variants cause problems. More Pacific whales preparing for Mars flight. It's all on today's VOA Asia. NATO is marking the 72nd anniversary of its founding. Henry Ridgewell reports the military alliance faces enduring threats across Europe and new challenges beyond into Asia.
It's 72 years since Western allies signed the Washington Treaty in 1949 to create NATO, based on the principle of collective self-defense. Russia remains its biggest challenge, says analyst Jonathan Isle.
We have a Russia which is not only willing to use force in order to threaten other European countries, but has actually used force and has forcefully annexed a bit of a territory of another country into itself as little as less than 10 years ago.
U.S. President Joe Biden has reaffirmed America's commitment to the organization. His predecessor, Donald Trump, once called NATO obsolete, which sent tremors through the transatlantic alliance.
The arrival of President Biden in the White House has, at a stroke, removed all such doubts.
Biden is also pushing for NATO to tackle other strategic threats, notes analyst Simona Saw.
Climate change cooperation as it pertains to security and defense, but even more broadly than this, technology, a new approach to Russia and China, approach to a new approach to how democracy is promoted and protected against disinformation and against subversion campaigns.
NATO faces numerous challenges, including ongoing violence in Afghanistan. Continuing attacks are complicating efforts to end the almost 20-year NATO mission. Also, internal tensions are simmering, not least over defense spending.
More than 90% of the people in the European Union, they live in a NATO country, but only 20% of NATO's defense spending comes from NATO EU members.
The United States will likely maintain pressure on European members to meet the defense spending target of 2% of GDP made at the 2014 NATO summit in Wales.
President Biden was one of the architects of the Welsh Defence Pledge. So in this sense, he is very much attached to the idea that Europeans have to invest, to continue to invest more in their defence.
Meanwhile, Turkey has purchased a Russian missile defence system, to the dismay of NATO allies.
Even Turkey does not believe that it will be better off outside NATO rather than within the alliance.
Despite the tensions, NATO remains the bedrock of European security as the alliance enters its 73rd year. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Myanmar's junta levies new charge against Aung San Suu Kyi. Myanmar's efforts to control COVID-19 crumble since February coup, according to aid groups. Japan begins COVID-19 vaccination efforts for citizens 65 and older. Mekong dams bring hardship to Thai villagers. Matsuyama becomes first Japanese golfer to wear Masters green. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also check us out on Twitter and at our website, voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden's top advisors are reviewing and formulating their policy toward North Korea, which continues to build its nuclear arms program despite many years of varied attempts to curtail the effort. Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton spoke with VOA about North Korea and recent engagement efforts. In the second of three parts, Ambassador Bolton discusses with VOA Korean correspondent Young-gyo Kim about President Biden's potential strategy and China's role.
One of the key choices that Biden team needs to make seems to be whether they should adopt incremental step-by-step approach towards North Korea's denuclearization. Do you think step-by-step approach will work?
No, I don't think step-by-step or action-by-action, as the North Koreans sometimes call it. It's gone through a variety of different labels, but it's basically the same approach. They make a promise to give up their nuclear weapons program, and they take one or two steps to carry that into effect, in exchange for which they get substantial economic benefits, delivery of heavy fuel oil during the Clinton administration, similar kinds of promises during the six-party talks, and now they want the relief of economic sanctions. And so the other parties to the agreement give them the economic relief they want, and then North Korea stops making progress in denuclearization. And there's a reason for that. It's very straightforward. All of the heavy lifting on the North Korean side comes at the end of their agreement, when they someday finally destroy the nuclear program. But the benefits that North Korea gets are all at the front end. In today's case, for example, the lifting of economic sanctions would have an immediate and very positive effect on what's left of the North Korean economy. Once they get steady again, then it becomes easier to evade the remaining sanctions. Their economy is more stable. The military is happier. So they get the benefits up front, and the downside to them comes at the end. Because it's disproportionate, North Korea actually gains strength from the early stages of an agreement. And since they never make it to the later stages of the agreement, these action-for-action programs have invariably worked out to benefit North Korea.
Recently, you wrote an opinion piece. It was titled, Biden Must Focus on China. Biden Must Confront North Korea via Beijing. And there you said it is time for the U.S. to focus on China, and China must now own up to its responsibility. How can the U.S. press China to own up to its responsibility?
Well, I think for many years, the government in the United States, in Democratic and Republican administrations, has said China is working with us to find a solution to the North Korean nuclear program. They hosted the six-party talks during the Bush administration. They try and pose in the press as being helpful to try and bridge the gap between North Korea and the United States. And the U.S. has gone along with that. I think it's time to call off the charade. China has used North Korea ever since the peninsula was partitioned for its own purposes. I mean, we all remember that the two communist parties in China and North Korea used to say they were as close as lips and teeth, very, very close. Certainly in the early days, there's no doubt that Chinese assistance to and Russian assistance to North Korea's missile program and its nuclear program was very important. Now, both Russia and China deny today that they're aiding either the missile or the nuclear program. I have my doubts about that. But the assistance that they gave very early was critical. And given China's economic influence in North Korea, it could still call the shots if it wants to. So we're in a very difficult situation right now between the U.S. and China for a number of reasons, stealing America's intellectual property, probably stealing South Korea's intellectual property, too. So it's not an optimistic time, but it's precisely for that reason that China's responsibility for the existence of the North Korean regime has to be on the bilateral U.S.-China agenda. And I think that's what shows, again, why we need very close cooperation between Seoul and Washington. We cannot allow North Korea or China to try and drive wedges between us. But we also can't ignore the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and that's that China is North Korea's lifeline.
Even during the Trump administration, many officials called out China, urged them they should implement sanctions on North Korea fully. Why didn't it work? What could have been done more?
Well, I think North Korea's economy is so fragile that even minimal assistance is enough to keep the regime going, which is what the regime cares about. It doesn't care for the people of North Korea.
Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton speaking with VOA Korean correspondent Young-gyo Kim. Join us tomorrow for part three, as North Korea's current threat is discussed and how Trump fell short in direct meetings with Kim Jong-un. Happening now in Asia, ousted Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi was recently charged with breaching a law intended to control the spread of COVID-19, according to her lawyers. She appeared by video link before a judge and is already facing charges of corruption and illegal possession of walkie-talkies. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We hope your day is going well, and we're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. The Biden administration has said it will not be involved in a national vaccine passport system, deferring instead to private companies to implement mechanisms for people to prove they have been vaccinated for travel and other activities. White House correspondent Patsy Wodecka-Swara has this report on why vaccine credentialing is a controversial issue in the United States.
Excited fans returning to New York's Yankee Stadium earlier this month for the first time since October 2019 as the new Major League Baseball season begins. They have to prove that they are coronavirus free.
Just showing the vaccination card after 14 days is good enough. Otherwise, I know people are getting tested.
This week, New York became the first state to offer a digital vaccine passport, a free app and website to prove COVID-free status either through vaccination or a negative COVID-19 test.
We've got to respect people's privacy. We got to make sure that the system is accurate. There's definitely more to be worked through, but I think they'll be part of the solution.
Private companies around the world already use digital vaccine certification in tourism, entertainment, and other industries. Several countries, including China and Israel, have launched official nationwide systems, but don't expect the U.S. to follow.
There will be no centralized universal federal vaccinations database and no federal mandate requiring everyone to obtain a single vaccination credential.
Vaccine certification is controversial in the U.S. Some Republican governors have even issued executive orders banning them.
Americans are often very skeptical of the idea of anything that might be centralized in the federal government, and they see that kind of centralization as being an affront to either privacy or to freedom.
The Biden administration is urging private entities to develop their own solutions, but will provide guidelines to meet certain standards, including accessibility and affordability. The World Health Organization is also against the idea of vaccine passports for travel between countries.
We're not certain that at this stage that the vaccine prevents transmission, and there are all those other questions, apart from the question of discrimination against people who are not able to have the vaccine for one reason or another.
While certification may help industries eager to jumpstart revenue, health experts say ultimately the answer is to simply vaccinate more people.
The more people who are vaccinated, if we really get to over 80%, then we don't have to worry about those vaccine passports.
Currently, about 20% of Americans are fully inoculated. With vaccine hesitancy still a factor, challenges remain for the country to reach herd immunity. Patsy Wodecka-Swara, VOA News.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. 21 miners remain trapped in a flooded coal mine in China's Xinjiang region. CCTV reported 8 other miners have been lifted out since the flooding began Saturday, and the rescue of the remaining miners continues. You'll find this and other big stories on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the CDC says cases of coronavirus clusters are increasing in the United States, in youth sports and daycare centers, while hospitals are reporting more younger adults being admitted with severe cases of the disease. As Mariama Diallo reports, coronavirus variants are to blame for the rise.
Speaking at the White House COVID briefing, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Rochelle Walensky says cases are rising among younger people as the country sees the increasing prevalence of coronavirus variants.
Across the country, we are hearing reports of clusters of cases associated with daycare centers and youth sports. Hospitals are seeing more and more younger adults, those in their 30s and 40s, admitted with severe disease. Data suggests this is all happening as we are seeing increasing prevalence of SARS-CoV-2 variants, with 52 jurisdictions now reporting cases of variants of concern.
The highly contagious B.1.1.7 variant originated in Britain. It's the most common strain circulating in the U.S. and has been shown to be more transmissible and infectious among younger Americans, she says.
In areas of substantial or high community transmission, CDC guidance specifically suggests refraining from new sports that are not outside and cannot be conducted at least 6 feet apart. Similarly, large events should also be deferred.
The Biden administration also said Wednesday the federal government is expanding coronavirus vaccine access to all federally qualified community health centers. White House COVID-19 advisor Andy Slavitt.
That we are expanding our community health center vaccine program so that the nearly 1,400 community health centers can sign up to receive and administer doses to their patients. Many community health centers are located in underserved communities and serve patients that are predominantly either uninsured or underinsured.
The U.S. leads the world with more than 30.9 million confirmed cases and more than 559,000 confirmed deaths, according to Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center. Slavitt says the vaccination program is ahead of schedule, with more than 108 million Americans having received at least one dose of the vaccine. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Making headlines in Asia, Thai authorities recorded almost 1,000 new coronavirus cases Monday, the highest daily increase for the country since the beginning of the pandemic. Health officials are concerned the number of infections could increase after this week's traditional Thai New Year holiday. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, marine experts estimate about 40,000 humpback whales are now migrating through Australian waters annually. That's up from about 1,500 a half century ago. The species has recovered strongly after the end of commercial hunting, and Australia is considering removing humpbacks from its threatened species list. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The humpback's annual journey from Antarctica to subtropical waters along Australia's east and west coasts is one of nature's great migrations. It's a journey of up to 10,000 kilometres and is undertaken between April and November. Scientists have estimated 40,000 humpback whales have been in Australian waters to mate and breed. It is a remarkable recovery from the height of commercial whaling in the early 1960s, when it was estimated there were fewer than 1,500 humpbacks. They were slaughtered mainly for their oil and baleen, or whale bone. Australia's Environment Department says no other whale species has recovered as strongly as the humpback since the end of commercial hunting, which ceased in Australia in 1978. Australia is now considering removing humpback whales from the threatened species list because of their growing numbers. The acrobatic humpbacks that can grow to 16 metres would still be protected in Australia. Conservationists, though, argue that they need more, not fewer, environmental safeguards to monitor the impact of climate change on krill, their main source of food. Krill are affected by the absorption of more carbon dioxide into the ocean. Olaf Meinecker, a research fellow in marine science at Queensland's Griffith University, says vigilance is needed to ensure the whales continue to thrive.
Generally speaking, yes, it's a great success story that humpback whales have come back. But obviously, we also need to ask questions as how will this continue in the future? How are present threats already impacting the population? And how are we going to detect changes in the future?
Scientists say humpbacks face a combination of other threats, including the over-harvesting of krill, pollution, habitat degradation, and entanglement in fishing nets. Calves also face attack by killer whales or sharks. The recovery of the humpback has helped the rapid growth of Australia's whale-watching industry. As their numbers have grown, much about the humpback, a species famous for its song, remains a mystery. Scientists don't know exactly, for example, where on Australia's Great Barrier Reef they mate and calve. Humpback whales live in all the world's oceans. They take their common name from a distinctive hump on the whale's back. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The U.S. space agency NASA is eyeing the first possible day to launch its flying robot on Mars. Plus, the space agency tests a moon capsule, and the European Space Agency calls for diversity. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us The Week in Space.
Just two buddies out on an interplanetary road trip this week as NASA's Perseverance and Ingenuity rovers posed for a selfie on the red planet. NASA says launching a helicopter from the Martian surface could now be just days away.
Release.
Last July, the space agency sent the Perseverance rover on a months-long journey to Mars spanning almost 55 million kilometers. Perseverance must now find the perfect launch pad for scientists and crew on Earth to test the Ingenuity helicopter. Project manager Mimi Ong says the challenge is chopping through an atmosphere with only 1% of the pressure on Earth.
The first and foremost challenge is to make a vehicle that's light enough, you know, to be lifted. And then second is to generate lift. The rotor system has to spin very fast.
The Wright brothers achieved the first successful flight in 1903, and NASA is looking to recapture that moment by attempting the first powered, controlled flight on another planet. Meanwhile, NASA conducted a drop test of its next-generation Orion moon capsule in Hampton, Virginia. Orion weighs more than 6,300 kilograms and is part of NASA's Artemis program, which aims to put the first woman and next man on the moon. In other news, the European Space Agency is hiring. For only the fourth time since the 1970s, the ESA is actively recruiting and says it seeks more female astronauts as well as people with disabilities. French astronaut and incoming ISS station commander Thomas Pesquet encourages people to apply.
Too many people are not going to apply, for example, to an astronaut selection because they think it's really too hard and it's for a different kind of different breed of people. It's not true. I mean, it's not true, and I hope I'm a proof of this. We're all normal people.
ESA plans to recruit 4 to 6 career astronauts. The agency has only sent 2 women to space. Finally, over protests from astronomers complaining they blocked their view of the sky, private spaceflight company SpaceX launched another 60 satellites to add to its orbiting Starlink global internet service, which the company says will reach underserved communities around the world. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
That's our program. Thanks for being with us today for VOA Asia, and join us again at the same time tomorrow. In the meantime, we're online. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Just look us up under our name, VOA Asia. We also thank our VOA Asia team, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead. Be safe. Be well.